and you're on the front porch where we tackle the tough issues facing Appalachia like you and your friends do on your front porch. We're facing a potential government shutdown here in West Virginia, but what does that actually mean? We'll ask the man in charge of paying the bills, State Auditor J.B. McCuskey. J.B., thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
We'll also ask how the state's new computer system went from Oasis to dried up watering hole and what he's trying to do to fix it. The Front Porch is sponsored by the Charleston Gazette-Mail, using its CGM app to deliver the latest in news, traffic, and weather at iTunes or Google Play. I'm Scott Finn, CEO of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, and we're joined, as always, by lawyer and conservative columnist Lori Lynn. Hey, Lori.
Hi, Scott.
She's also a mother. She's a lot of things.
That's true.
And just to disclose, you guys are friends, right?
Correct.
JB was the first person I met when I came to visit Charleston.
Excellent. And we also have Rick Wilson, liberal with the American Friends Service Committee. Hey, Rick.
You're probably really proud of that dried up watering hole thing, aren't you?
It's actually full of money. Spend money.
All right. Well, let's get to it. Auditor McCuskey, if there is a government shutdown and we're a couple weeks away from that possibility, who gets hurt?
Everybody. The whole state, every one of its citizens, every state employee, people that do business with the state. It would be catastrophic. You know, we're going to be as ready as we can be, but the end result is pain. We just can't let it happen.
So walk us through the mechanics of it. I mean, at a basic level, the state runs out of money on July 1st because we haven't appropriated the money.
Yeah, so that's an interesting distinction to make. The state doesn't actually run out of money, and the state actually wouldn't stop collecting money. But what the state wouldn't have is a legal document appropriating funds that would allow them to be spent. And so the trick for me comes in then that as the only statewide official who has personal and criminal liability associated with my office, how do I fulfill my duties as I believe them in my oath of office to protect the health, safety, and welfare of both the state and its people while also potentially breaking the law in paying bills without appropriations? So you bring up an excellent point in that there is a big difference between having money and having money appropriated.
Let's just play it out. July 1st comes around, and right now there's no furlough bill. That would change things somewhat. But, you know, under current law, what will you do on July 2nd? What happens?
So there's a couple scenarios that we're working through in my office. And the first of them is to find a way to engage the judicial system of the state of West Virginia to provide guidance as to what my legal duties and abilities are. So that comes with, again, from my point of view, a little bit of danger, right? So I have a set of beliefs that I believe what my office needs to do in order to fulfill it. There's also a set of laws that dictate that, but then there's also a set of judges who might have another opinion on that. So what is likely to happen is that we will figure out a way to get some opinion from some judge that explains what my duties legally are. And the case law throughout the country in these situations indicates that the financial officer in charge of making these payments has the ability to continue the financial well-being of the government.
Would you say I'm going to pay police officers, but I'm not going to pay maybe less essential people? I mean, would you have that kind of latitude potentially?
I mean, maybe. The problem then comes, how do I interact with the agency to find the people? How do I get those specific people into the payroll system? I mean, we have 55,000 state employees. We have, you know, 70-some odd agencies. They all have different payrolls. Another thing that this brings up is we have a really crazy payroll system in the state of West Virginia. It is disparate. It is in some ways unfair. It's also very inefficient and very, very expensive. If we learn anything from all of this, it's that we need to centralize and uniform our payroll. We can save probably in the hundreds of millions of dollars per year if we are able to do that. But that's besides the point. Yes, Lori, I think to your question, prison guards, state police officers, people who work in mental hospitals, people who work in state hospitals, we need to pay all of our debt obligations, right? There needs to be an overarching theory as to what needs to get paid. Then we need to figure out how to do it. I'm not 100% sure it's even logistically possible. We're running through these scenarios in my office right now. I mean, it would be a Herculean task to accomplish that if the government were running. It would be even more monumental to do so in the event of a shutdown.
Just on a practical level, I think it's unlikely that Auditor McCuskey is going to be sent to prison for paying police officers. If I were him, I'd be worried about it. I think you certainly don't just blithely, you know, cut a check without having some kind of legal background. An opinion from a judge would help. Aside from that, how do you do this practically? How do you handle the paperwork, the computer stuff is really kind of more of a hurdle.
So hypothetically, though, if you went to prison and we didn't pay the guards, you might be able to, you know, get out.
Yeah, I'd probably be the only one that stayed in, honestly.
So which court would you go to, by the way?
Which jail?
What court?
The Circuit Court of Kanawha County. The state Supreme Court doesn't have original jurisdiction in this area, so you'd have to start it in a circuit court. And the thing that becomes hard is, you know, I'm going to end up adverse to all these agencies at some point probably if this happens. And so how do you find a willing partner to go into this? Because I would have to get sued in order for them to determine the outcome. So it would have to be X state agency versus the state auditor. You know, it might start off friendly, but Lord only knows what will happen down the road. You know, if they believe something's essential and I don't, I mean, things can turn very quickly and litigation can go from friendly to unfriendly in a heartbeat. So there's danger in that as well.
You're not asking the Educational Broadcasting Authority of West Virginia to sue you, are you, Auditor?
No.
Good.
I'm not.
We're not in this situation.
I'm looking at your lawyer right now, and I don't want to face her.
So what's the real drop dead date for the legislature to figure this out, for us to be able to have a functioning state government?
I will say that the real drop-dead date to ensure that the budget and the payrolls that begin in July are done properly, are checked properly, and are assuredly done legally is roughly the 19th, or West Virginia Day would be a good way to say that.
So does it have to be all the way through, the governor signed it and everything, by the 19th?
If the legislature passes it and the governor makes the indications that he isn't going to make a lot of line item vetoes and he's going to sign it, there's a lot of things we can do before it's actually signed to get it ready. But it's also kind of silly for us to start doing some of those things now, because you could really spin your tires if things change drastically. So we are doing some preparatory things now. If we get something by the 20th, I feel very confident that there will be unnoticeable consequences to that late of a budget. Anything past that, we're risking consequences.
You know, they often say that businesses, you know, look for stability. And if you think how does it look for West Virginia to be in like an annual drama cliffhanger?
I would say that if this were happening a decade ago, it would look a lot worse than it is now. But we are surrounded by a country full of states in financial difficulty. There are some states who are doing well, but this scenario is being played out in state houses throughout this country right now. And so would it be better for us not to be having this problem? Yeah. Absolutely. But is it as big of a deal as it once was? No. I mean, I think having a world-class education system and strong infrastructure and a fair tax system means a whole lot more to businesses than whether or not the legislature doesn't get a budget on the date every year.
So there's a furlough bill that is in the legislature. If that were to pass, how does that change things?
It can a lot, depending on what the furlough bill says. So we were speaking a little bit ago about how we might need a judicial opinion to explain what happens in this event. So if the legislature were to act, it could usurp the need for that, because then they would have spoken. And at the end of the day, their opinion on all of this is actually probably the most important, right? So if the legislature speaks to what happens in the event of a shutdown, all of our roles can be defined by those who I believe are supposed to be defining them. I would prefer that. That would be the easiest for me, would be to do what the legislature tells me to do, because I believe constitutionally that's what their role is.
And so depending on that bill, state workers may or may not get paid at the end of a furlough. It just depends what that bill says.
Yeah, that's correct.
Well, we're state workers here, so I mean, I'm going to be just completely selfish. My own employees have questions.
Just so you know, please have them call my office. Any state employee who has questions, anybody in my office will be more than happy to answer any questions they have.
People are super, you know, nervous about several things. I'll ask a life and death one. If there's a shutdown, how does PEIA work? Will my son be able to get his medicine?
The answer to all of these questions are I don't know, but I will tell you what I think will happen. My presumption is that in the absence of a furlough bill that addresses the PEIA issue, PEIA will continue benefits to everyone, but will discontinue payments to vendors, meaning you would go to the pharmacy, your drugs would be covered, and then once the government reopened, PEIA would be refunded, and then they would pay for the prescription that we were discussing. They work on a billing cycle just like anybody else, right? So it's not like PEIA pays for that prescription within 5 hours. You know, the real trick there is just to make sure you're still covered. That's the most important thing. And so we would need to find a way to fund PEIA to the level that they could ensure coverage would be more important than ensuring payments.
If there is no furlough bill, legally or at least officially, it looks like employees would be laid off on July the 1st. Does that mean they lose all their accrued benefits that they've gotten from being state employees for all these years?
There are two ways to approach all of these questions, right? What does the law, which is predicated on passing a budget, say about being laid off? And what do we do about this situation where we are operating in a world that wasn't contemplated by the Constitution. So everyone who talks about what the auditor is supposed to do and all this stuff, all the things in the Constitution starts and ends with the legislature passing a budget, and then all of the laws that they're talking about afterwards are in the event of there being a budget. So you can say it's illegal for the auditor to make payments that aren't appropriated, but that is presupposing that the appropriations were made and that we were making one outside of the appropriations that were dictated by the legislature. We would be living in a world where all of those predetermined facts wouldn't have happened. And so there's a very strong argument, in my opinion, that a lot of those things don't necessarily apply in the event of a shutdown, because the silence on the part of the legislature indicates that they meant these apply in the event of there being a budget. Would they lose their accrued benefits? And the answer to your question is I don't think they would have to. I mean, I think that probably the black letter of the law says that they should, but I'm not 100% sure that they're laid off. I mean, there's a very different thing between having the inability to pay somebody and laying somebody off. I mean, in a very real world sense, those two things have different consequences. And so anybody who didn't want to come back to work wouldn't necessarily have to.
When I hear you describing, you know, we've all heard of jury nullification, where a jury listens to the facts of a case and decides, you know what, I know the letter of the law says this, but we're going to do the other thing anyway. This sounds more like the equivalent of that. Basically, everyone realizes that this was not anticipated, and the letter of the law might say, for example, if I'm let go because of a shutdown, I lose all my benefits. But the political, you know, repercussions of that and the unfairness of it means that everybody who's involved will just say, yeah, the law says that, but no one's going
to
do it.
I hesitate to say everyone involved, and I think it would probably be more accurate to say that while that letter of the law was not intended to work in the shutdown scenario. So what you would be saying is that law means this in this scenario, and this is a different scenario. And so what we believe is that we should treat people as fairly as possible, particularly in this specific instance. And that means changing our view or, you know, changing what would happen under normal circumstances for the special circumstance.
So what I hear you saying is this is not something anticipated by the Constitution. So maybe if we could take it back a little bit.
Let me just stop. It is anticipated by the Constitution. The fact that it isn't spoken about, to me, says that they anticipated it always happening. They didn't want to contemplate this happening because they knew how bad it would be.
Yeah, exactly.
Its silence is contemplation in and of itself.
Just want to step back a minute. You spent two terms in the House of Delegates mm-hmm. before you took this office. I'm going to invite you, don't feel like you have to do this, but to diagnose the problem for us. I mean, what do you see as the fundamental problem that's causing this budget crisis?
Not enough money. I mean, the fundamental problem that's causing the budget crisis is that for years we lived off of industries that produce tax revenue and produce jobs and things, but masked underlying economic issues that were never addressed. And so now we have a government that has grown with the size of its income that no longer can sustain itself based on its population. So we have the biggest government we've ever had and the least people we've ever had, which makes no sense. That's an inverse relationship that shouldn't have ever happened. And so a lack of foresight for years. And then the inherent legislative process makes this system both work and frustrating. Legislators acting on their authority given to them by small specific districts gives them a voice of a very small group of people, which is a great thing, but it also gives a lot of voices, which makes consensus hard to find. And so what you have is a lot of people who are working very hard for the people that elected them, but the people that elected them don't necessarily agree with the people in the district next to them. So these are things that we celebrate when it takes a long time that something you don't want to pass, and things that we get really angry about when we think, oh, they should just get something done. We have to remember that that's the way that this is set up, and it's set up for a reason.
And finally, as you gear up for this impending tornado at work, the McCuskey family has something impending going on at home. What's going on there?
More tornadoes. This one's more of a poop-oriented tornado, but my wife is getting ready to have a baby. Any day now. I have my phone in front of me in case it actually happened while we were on the air here. We got a two-year-old at home, and we're getting ready to have an infant at the house as well. So we have assembled our own little crisis management team if the government were to unfathomably shut down and I were to be having to work while my wife was at home with two little tiny babies, which would be crazy.
Oh, my goodness. And what's the due date?
The due date is actually the 29th of June, so 2 days prior to the shutdown, which, I mean, that'll give me about 12 hours of sleep if it happens on that day, and we'll be good to go on July 1st.
We're speaking with West Virginia State Auditor J.B. McCuskey. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to ask about the state's new computer system. You spent a pretty penny on it, and the auditor has come into office kind of in the middle of this thing. He's trying to make sure that we spend a little bit less. So we'll find out about that. But first, this front porch doesn't have enough organization. And I think we need to have our first cabinet meeting of the front porch. And so I call this meeting to order. I just want to say that The Front Porch is undoubtedly the best podcast of all time. It's the greatest. It's getting the most downloads. It's achieved so much in the last few months. And now I turn it over to my cabinet members. We'll start with Rick Olson.
May I just say, Scott, that it is the acme of my existence, the high point of my life, an honor and a privilege to serve this administration of the front porch.
I agree with everything my colleague Rick said, and I want to also say that, Scott, the way that you produce this podcast, the way that you work the soundboard, I've learned so much from watching you. It's been an honor and a privilege. I can't imagine anything ever surpassing this. It's fabulous. Again, everyone says so.
You all out there, we don't need your help. We don't need it, but because you love it so much, you're going to call anyway. It's 800-RADIO-87, or you're going to pledge online at wvpublic.org because you want to be a part of what is undoubtedly the greatest podcast of all time.
Making podcasting great again.
We have made podcasting great again, and with your support, we'll make it even greater. Thanks. Okay, we're back, and we're talking to West Virginia State Auditor J.B. McCuskey. When I first got to state government, 8 or 9 years ago, they're using this program that looked like it was out of the 70s or 80s. You all remember these programs if you're over the age of 30, where you had to tab to get to the right spot. It didn't even really use a mouse. So it was very cumbersome. And we just thought to ourselves, man, this is crazy how old this thing is. And then all of a sudden, a team of people, including your predecessor, Glenn Gaynor, came up with a solution. They were going to solve this, bring us into the next century with this OASIS. Which is designed by the same people that made healthcare.gov, the Obamacare program, just putting it out there. On one hand, we use it here, West Virginia Public Broadcasting. It looks fairly modern, but I ask the people that use it every single day, they swear up and down that although the old system was crazy old, that they spend much more time using the new system. And this is after they've gotten 2 years of training and they've been using it for a while. It doesn't seem to have accomplished its goal of making government more efficient yet. On top of that, there's been an audit that came out that said we were spending $24 million over the last few years on consultants to help us run the thing. So you're in the middle of this. You're trying to fix that situation. What are you trying to do?
And I get it. New things often take longer. But I think in some ways the system is set up to generate a larger amount of information and provide more access to data about what people are actually doing. And I think sometimes that just takes longer. So to say that the old one was faster may be true, but it also may be true that it didn't give us the same level of information about how things are actually working. Well, and one thing it does do is we're in the final stages of implementing the state's new transparency website, which would have been much more difficult if we hadn't had OASIS, which puts all the state's financial data into one place. And so what you're going to find is that the open West Virginia checkbook, which I think is what we're going to call it, unless I can come up with something less boring than that.
That makes me feel like I can go and write checks against it, which is cool, but I don't know if you want that getting out.
You can try. The treasurer and I probably won't finish them off for you. But there's things like that, right? So we have a new world of government information that's going to be available to people. And these are things that are only contemplated in the world of these new computer systems. And so in the old one, it would have been almost impossible. In the new one, you know, it's going to be really easy. And you're going to have almost real-time access to basically every penny that's spent.
Otter, we're going to wrap this thing up. Is there anything else that you wanted to make sure got said?
You know, it's not the best time in the world to be a West Virginian. But, I mean, this is still a pretty neat place. I think everybody saw on Twitter this almost heaven thing last week, which, I mean, exposed me to a lot of neat pictures and stuff I hadn't seen. And we're a self-deprecating people by nature, which I think we need to change. I think that we're trying to sell our state as a place that's the best place on earth to live and to raise a family, and for me, it is that. And I think that starts with us believing in ourselves and telling other people about that. And for me, the reason that West Virginia is the best is because we have a set of values that are shared that I think don't stem from like what's below our feet, but much more so what's between our shoulders. And so we have a small business and a family, and people shop at our store because they want us to succeed. And, you know, if something happened and, you know, my wife got sick, my neighbors would come over and watch my kid. And that doesn't happen everywhere.
What's your store?
I hesitate to plug it, but it's okay. Called Geraniums. It's on Bridge Road.
Geraniums?
Yeah. Okay. And that's, and it's not mine. It's really my wife's. I mean, I'm just sort of there to make sure that she is well taken care of when she gets home. These things don't exist everywhere. And I think there's an entire generation of people that are coming into this country and coming into their own and coming into the workforce that appreciate that kind of lifestyle more than they ever used to. And I think we need to sell our state as a place where you can both live and be loved and do the things you love. And I think the sky's the limit for us. I feel eternally optimistic about West Virginia.
State Auditor J.B. McCuskey, thank you for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
So, Rick, what's your Bible verse today?
I don't have a verse. I'm thinking more like a Bible story, and that would be from Genesis when Joseph had the dream that led him to anticipate 7 years of plenty and then 7 years of famine and prepared for that. So I'm hoping we get past the famine stage here in West Virginia.
All right. Sounds good. That's Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee. We're also joined by Lori Lynn. I'm Scott Finn, CEO of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And if we are not furloughed, I'll be here next week. Take care.
And you may find yourself living in a shotgun shack. And you may find yourself in another part of the world. And you may find yourself behind the wheel of a large automobile. And you may find yourself in a beautiful house with a beautiful wife. And you may ask yourself,